You're listening to the Maritime History Program, and I'm your host, Brandon Huebner, bringing you the latest installment, Episode 8, The Middle Kingdom Mariners. Not much in the way of introduction today, so let's just get right to it. When we left off, the Old Kingdom had collapsed, and the First Intermediate Period had begun. There is little maritime-related evidence from this period, but let's take a brief look at the synopsis of events from the First Intermediate Period, and we'll get a good idea of why there isn't much in the way of maritime evidence. If you remember back to last time, you may recall that Pepi II was the last pharaoh before the First Intermediate Period, and following his death, there was a drought, the Nubians waged a war to gain their independence from Egyptian control, and the Egyptian government had become highly unstable because of the pharaoh Pepi's long reign. All these circumstances culminated in a long dispute over succession to the throne. The 7th and 8th dynasties were periods of relative impotence for the pharaohs. Only one of them managed to hold on to the throne for longer than one whole year, and the same pharaoh, Ibi, was the only one who managed to complete a monument in his honor. You could say that the pharaohs had fallen far from the decadence of the Old Kingdom. After the 8th dynasty, Egypt reverted back to the regional power bases that had been the main units of control, even before Narmer originally unified Upper and Lower Egypt. Those who controlled Lower Egypt during the First Intermediate Period were loosely confederated under the leadership of a ruler who ruled from the town of Heracleopolis. These leaders are considered to form the beginning of the 10th dynasty. The 11th dynasty, though, was partially concurrent with the 10th. The 11th was made up of rival rulers who controlled Upper Egypt, with their overlord exercising his control from the province of Thebes. As I said earlier, we don't have much evidence of maritime matters from the First Intermediate Period, but this period came to an end when a Theban ruler named Mentuhotep II emerged victorious from a civil war. After leading the Theban provinces to victory against Heracleopolis, Mentuhotep began consolidating his power over both Upper and Lower Egypt, effectively reunifying Egypt and ushering in the Middle Kingdom. As we now transition into the maritime history of Egypt's Middle Kingdom period, we will take a look at archaeological evidence and the ancient depictions of boats, as we have been doing so far. But one thing that sets the Middle Kingdom apart is the rise of literature as an art form, so we will incorporate that as well. While artifacts and depictions do give us good insight into the technicalities of maritime history, the literature and works like the Tale of the Shipwrecked Sailor give us some of our earliest glimpses into the imaginations of ancient Egyptian sailors, but also the everyday citizens who must have wondered what lay outside the Nile Valley. In this episode, then, we're going to look at a few artifacts from the Middle Kingdom, and then one literary piece that relates to maritime history. First off, a landmark early in the Middle Kingdom concerns an explorer named Hanu, who was the first to reopen the trade routes with both Libya and the land of Punt, after Pharaoh Mentuhotep III ordered him to take ships from the Nile and make the trek over 100 miles east across the Wadi that led to the shores of the Red Sea. The inscription that I'm about to read, found inscribed on the rocky walls of Wadi Hammamat, reveals Hanu's pride at having fulfilled the pharaoh's orders and having defeated his opposition along the way. Hanu's inscription says the following: "His Holiness sent me to dispatch a ship to Punt to bring for him fresh myrrh from the sheikhs over the Red Land, by reason of the fear of him in the highlands. Then I went forth from Koptos upon the road which His Majesty commanded me. There was with me an army of the south, every office of the king's house, those who were in town and field, united, came after me. The army I cleared the way before, overthrowing those hostile toward the king. The hunters and the children of the highlands were posted as the protection of my limbs. Every official body of His Majesty was placed under my authority. They reported messengers to me, as one alone commanding, to whom many hearken. I went forth with an army of 3,000 men. I made the road a river, and the red land a stretch of field, for I gave a leathern bottle, a carrying pole, 2 jars of water, and 20 loaves to each one among them every day. The asses were laden with sandals. Now I made 12 wells in the bush, and 2 wells in Idahet, 20 square cubits in one, and 31 square cubits in the other. I made another in Iheteb, 20 by 20 cubits on each side. Then I reached the Red Sea. Then I made this ship, and I dispatched it with everything, when I had made for it a great oblation of cattle, bulls, and ibexes. Now after my return from the Red Sea, I executed the command of His Majesty, and I brought for him all the gifts which I had found in the regions of God's land, or Punt. I returned through the valley of Hammamat. I brought for him august blocks for statues belonging to the temple. Never was brought down the like thereof for the king's court. Never was done the like of this by any king's confidant, sent out since the time of the god. I did this for the majesty of my lord, because he so much loved me. Aside from the significance of the fact that Hennu reopened some of the important trade routes to Egypt's east, and was quite proud of it, I might add, these trade routes were significant during the time of the Old Kingdom as well, as we've seen, but apart from all of that, there's also an interesting line from the inscription that may allude to something that we have also already mentioned. The line where Hennu states that he, quote, made the road a river, has been seen as possibly alluding to the Egyptian practice of building their seagoing vessels in the Nile Valley, then disassembling them, carrying them east across the wadi of their choice, and then reassembling them for use on the Red Sea. If this is indeed the idea that Hennu intended to convey by phrasing the line in that manner, well, it's an apt turn of phrase that captures the commercial functions of roadways, both on solid ground and in the water. Before we jump over to another one of our main items for today's episode, let's take just a minute to look at a debate about an event that may or may not have occurred during a time frame around Hennu's expedition at the beginning of the Middle Kingdom period. The Middle Kingdom began somewhere in the vicinity of 2000 BCE, give or take. If we then assume that Hennu did indeed conduct his expeditions during the reign of Mentuhotep III, then his expeditions probably occurred somewhere nearer to 1950 BCE. The event that I wanted to briefly mention here is claimed by the famous Greek geographer and historian Strabo to have occurred during the reign of Senusret III, who was a pharaoh who reigned in the latter half of the 1800s BCE, so well into the 12th dynasty. In his famous work, The Geography, Strabo claims that Senusret III oversaw the cutting of a canal that connected the northern part of the Nile River with the Red Sea. This canal would in classical times become known as the Canal of the Pharaohs, and the benefit of such a canal is pretty obvious if you take a look at the map. It would eliminate the need for overland caravans to haul goods the distance from the Red Sea inland to the Nile River. What is more, we have a great deal of evidence to suggest that there was indeed a canal between these two bodies of water, in the geographic area that Strabo claimed it to have been located. The main problem, though, isn't whether the canal existed or even where it existed. This problem is a problem of timing. When exactly was the canal first dug in a way that fully connected the Red Sea with the Nile? While Strabo claims that the canal was constructed in the 19th century BCE, Herodotus instead claims that the canal wasn't fully constructed until the 6th century BC, when Pharaoh Necho II oversaw its creation. It would certainly be interesting to claim such an early date for the construction of an ancient precursor of the Suez Canal, but the preponderance of the evidence indicates that the canal wasn't constructed in full until much later, probably the 6th century, as Herodotus says. Herodotus does recognize the fact that Senusret III, back in the 18th century, constructed canals, but he implies that these canals were smaller offshoots of the Nile, built simply for local purposes, and not built to make one gargantuan project that would radically alter the way Egypt communed with the Red Sea. Of course, debate still continues about when exactly the Canal of the Pharaohs was first completed, and some maintain that it was never fully finished until the time of the Ptolemaic dynasty. In the end, regardless of whether Senusret did or didn't actually complete the canal, our next item for today gives us a unique perspective on Egypt's connection with the Red Sea and the land of Punt that we've encountered a few times now. The tale of the shipwrecked sailor is generally seen as being the oldest written shipwreck narrative. It's ostensibly the account of a shipwreck survivor, and although it reveals a little more about how Egypt viewed the mythical, or not-so-mythical, land of Punt, and it gives us one of the earliest examples of a sailor's being able to forecast the weather at sea, the contents of the tale also veer off into the realm of the fantastical. So we have to look for the line that divides reality from fantasy, a line that can be very hard to find. If you're interested in hearing the tale in its entirety, as it is a little bit long, I've elected to record it as a supplementary episode in connection with this one. I've made it available on the main website, which you can access on the program page through the Boat Radio website. I've named this supplementary episode 8.5 to help distinguish it, so if you don't care that much about the story, feel free to skip the extra episode. Or you can probably find a text of it online to just read for yourself rather than listen to. This bare-bones summary of the tale is taken from Lionel Casson's classic work, The Ancient Mariners. I had set out for the Mines of the King, the anonymous storyteller relates, in a ship 180 feet long and 60 wide. We had a crew of 120, the pick of Egypt. The mines must be those in the Sinai Peninsula, so the departure was made from some Red Sea port. The ship's size is imposing. It was no little coaster, but a full-fledged cargo vessel. A storm broke while we were still at sea, he continues. We flew before the wind. The ship went down. Of all in it, only I survived. I was cast upon an island and spent 3 days alone. I stayed in the shade. Then I set forth to find what I could put in my mouth. I found figs and vines, all kinds of fine leeks, fruit and cucumbers. There were fish and fowl. Everything was there. I satisfied myself, and there was still some left over. When I had made a fire drill, I kindled a fire and made a burnt offering for the gods. So far, then, nothing that we couldn't find in the pages of Robinson Crusoe. But things suddenly change. Then I heard the sound of thunder and thought it was a wave. Trees broke and the earth quaked. I uncovered my face and found that a serpent had drawn near. It was 45 feet long, and its beard was 2 feet long. Its body was covered with gold, and its eyebrows were real lapis lazuli. The serpent's looks, it turns out, were deceiving. It was most considerate and an accommodating creature. It took the sailor up in its mouth tenderly, carried him to its lair, listened sympathetically to his story, and then comforted him with the news that, after 4 comfortable months on the island, one of the Pharaoh's ships would come along, pick him up, and carry him home. In gratitude, the sailor burst out with a promise to bring it thank offerings of all sorts of incense. Thereupon it laughed at me, and it said, "I am the Prince of Punt, and myrrh that is my very own." As if to confirm these words, when the rescue ship, as prophesied, did come along, the serpent sent the sailor off with a full cargo of incense of every conceivable type. 2 months later, he was safely home. All right, even though this tale of shipwreck and salvation may sound a little trite to us 4,000 years after it was first committed to writing, it's still significant both for its age and for what it can tell us about how the Middle Kingdom Egyptians viewed and related to the sea. Obviously, there are quite a few interpretational barriers in our way as we try to fully understand the tale. For instance, what were the origins of the story? Was it meant to be purely historical or a purely allegorical account? And if it wasn't purely one or the other, then which parts of the story are which? I don't like to have to say this, but as with many pieces of ancient literature, we really don't know. Various theories have been bandied about, all leading to slightly different conclusions. I'll highlight just a few points that, in my view, tip the scale in favor of viewing this ancient tale more as allegorical than literal, although as we've seen, the land of Punt was probably a physical location to which Egyptians sailed at various points in their history. First off, the tale of the shipwrecked sailor contains no names with which to identify the characters, not even a name for the story's narrator, the sailor who was shipwrecked on an island with a giant serpent. Were this tale intended to commemorate an actual event, as many Egyptian tales seem more so to have done, then you would think that the narrator would want to share his name and the names of the other people involved. A second point that weighs in favor of a non-literal interpretation can be seen in the conversations that the sailor has with the serpent after he's stranded on the island. Without going into too much detail here, the conversations focus not purely on rescue or geographical points, but also on issues of morality, human nature, and whether or not fate or a deity was to blame for the sailor's shipwreck. So points of philosophy, almost. The lack of names, and then the philosophical moralizing tone of the conversations, add up to a conclusion that this tale wasn't intended as a history, even if it may have originally been based on a sailor who was actually shipwrecked. Aside from all of these points, I do also tend to think that the presence of a giant talking serpent within the narrative should also give us a little bit of a hint. So although we can't precisely date the tale of the shipwrecked sailor, it's an indicator that Egypt's focus had again turned to foreign trade and to the expeditions that took place during the early Middle Kingdom. That trade began fairly early on, as we saw with Hanu, and timbers excavated near the pyramid of Senusret I at El Lisht give us evidence that Egyptians were again using local timber to construct ships of varying styles, using mortise and tenon joints again. Everyday boats and even funerary boats were also still in use, as we can see from the growing prevalence of miniature boat models in the archaeological record. These models were buried with various persons during the Middle Kingdom. Several pristine examples come from the tomb of a man named Meketra, who served as both chancellor and as high steward under at least two different Middle Kingdom pharaohs. I'll include photos of several of these boat models on the main website, so be sure to check them out to see exquisite examples of miniature boats from the Middle Kingdom. In addition to the boat models, there is also inscriptional evidence from four copper chests that were found hidden in the foundations of a temple near Thebes. These chests bore the engraved name of Amenemhat II, who was a 12th dynasty pharaoh. He succeeded Senusret I. Inside, these chests carried a wealthy treasure of various objects from around the ancient world. It included lapis lazuli from Mesopotamia, and silver cups that are identical in design to cups that were designed on Minoan Crete. I'll try to make the connection again when we get to this point in our narrative, but in a later episode I plan to take a closer look at this treasure when we talk about the Minoans. For now, though, leaving aside the maritime connections of the Minoans, although, as we just saw, they did have some type of connection with Egypt very early in their history. But anyway, the most important inscribed evidence from maritime activity during the Middle Kingdom comes from a stone block in Memphis. It contains the annals of Amenemhat II. On this block, among many other things, there is mention of at least two separate military voyages to a region that's been identified as modern-day Lebanon, the ancient region where sat the city known as Byblos. The annals record the ships of both expeditions as returning with a wide variety of spoils, ranging from thousands of prisoners and tons of precious metals to pine resin and the ever-coveted timber from the Lebanese cedar forests. One voyage mentioned in the inscription seems to have returned with a large concentration of both bronze and malachite, which led scholars to conclude that this Egyptian expedition may have even reached to the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. We'll look at some of the connections between Egypt, Cyprus, the Levant, and the early Mycenaeans and Minoans. We'll get into all of this more fully in upcoming episodes. So hopefully I'll connect some of the dots there for you. For now, though, it's significant that these mentions of maritime voyages are all contained within a single year's narrative from Amenemhat's annals during his reign as pharaoh. The short span of time that contains so much maritime activity can serve as a good basis for us to assume that both during his reign and during those of other Middle Kingdom pharaohs, Egypt was busy with maritime expeditions to the Levant and probably to other locales in the eastern Mediterranean. Unfortunately, little clear-cut evidence of seagoing ships has been linked to the Middle Kingdom period, and almost all maritime artifacts that have been discovered so far are of smaller riverine vessels. Recent excavations at Red Sea sites have uncovered some fragmentary evidence of seagoing vessels, particularly at a site called Wadi Gawasis, so maybe more will be found in the coming years. At present, though, the best physical maritime evidence from the Middle Kingdom comes from six boat pits that were discovered outside the Pyramid of Senusret III in the years between 1893 and 1895. That's when the boats were discovered. Senusret III reigned at the height of the 12th dynasty, and the Middle Kingdom as a whole. He gained a reputation as a warrior pharaoh who waged several campaigns against Nubia and built a series of fortresses there, marking the southern boundary of Egypt's Middle Kingdom control. The boats that were discovered in pits next to his pyramid at Dasher are now known as the Dasher boats. Very original, I know. And they've been variously interpreted, although many now think that they could have been funeral boats, like the Khufu ships. The Dasher boats, though, are much smaller than the completed Khufu ship. Each one of the Dasher boats measures in at around 30 feet long, about 9 meters, 8 feet wide and only 4 feet high. If these are indeed Senusret III's funerary boats, then the drastic size difference between the Khufu ship and the Dasher boats could signal either that Egypt's perception of an ideal boat for the afterlife had changed, or, more simply, just that a lack of resources prevented the construction of larger ships. Regardless of the reason, it's apparent that despite their smaller size, the Dasher boats also show evidence of improvement in construction technique. Cross beams are a prominent feature of the boats. They provide internal support for the outer shell. Rather than lashing the planks together to hold the mortise and tenon joints secure, the Dasher boats also contain dovetail clamps that secure the planks together from inside the hull. There is some debate about whether these dovetail clamps were an original feature of the ship's construction, or if maybe they were added at a later date, but hard proof of either theory there is pretty much impossible at this point. In any event, the boats were masterfully built using imported cedar, and their decoration is what has led several scholars to conclude that they were funerary vessels rather than practical ones. Originally, they were all decorated with red, black, and blue lines over a white or green background. The rudder stanchions had representations of hawks' heads on their upper ends, and the rudders themselves were painted with flowers and eyes. Those paintings have worn off over the intervening years, but several of the Dasher boats still exist in their entire form. A few remain in Cairo, but one has found its way to the Field Museum in Chicago. I've actually had the fortune to be able to see this one myself on several occasions. So if you're ever in Chicago, or Cairo for that matter, take a little extra time to go visit one of these boats from 12th Dynasty Egypt. I think, like I did, you may come away with a greater appreciation for the boat builders of old. Aside from the Dasher boats, which are the best example of maritime technology from the Middle Kingdom, after Senusret III was buried with these boats at Dasher, somewhere around 1800 BCE, he was succeeded by Amenemhat III. This pharaoh reigned for almost 50 years, which, as we saw with Pepi II, was an inordinately long reign in the context of other ancient Egyptian pharaohs. And as with Pepi II's long reign that ushered in the first intermediate period, Amenemhat III's long reign led to a succession struggle that drastically weakened Egypt's central government and power structures. While Amenemhat III was succeeded by either his grandson or stepson, we're not sure which, but this successor became a fourth pharaoh to bear the same name. His reign was short, and it was largely a failure. Drought further contributed to Egypt's instability, and the last pharaoh of the Middle Kingdom was Sobekneferu. This pharaoh was the first historically attested female king of Egypt, but unfortunately for her, her reign was also short-lived, and she died with no heirs around 1750 BC. With her death, Egypt entered its second intermediate period, another time of relative disconnection between Egypt and its foreign neighbors. It was at this same relative historical juncture that Hammurabi died, and the Mesopotamian sea trade began to wane, in addition to the shrinking influence of the Indus Valley civilization. A rather somber note to end on today, but when we pick up next time, we will move forward to look at the maritime evidence that crops up after Egypt rises again and transitions into the New Kingdom period. I anticipate that we'll spend one episode on the early New Kingdom maritime history, possibly one more after that to help wrap up Egypt's maritime matters, but then we'll move on to look at the Minoans, the Mycenaeans, the Trojan War, the Sea Peoples, and whatever else pops up in there along the way. As far as maritime history is concerned, we're just barely getting underway here on the program, so don't stray too far. Otherwise, thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join me again next week at the same time. If you like what you've heard today, visit the program page on boatradio.net. There you can find a link to my main website, where I have supplementary maps, images, source lists, and other beneficial supplementary materials. The website also has some info about how you can help support the continued production of this free and independent program. Plus, you can find links to connect with the program on social media for other news and interesting info about maritime archaeology and history. I hope you'll join me next week and every week thereafter as we progress through the stories of maritime history together. Until next time, fair winds and following seas. Thanks for listening to the Maritime History Program.